The jobs picture today:
two steps forward, one step back.
From 8 p.m. American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It is September 9th.
Happy Friday. Coming up, we'll talk to a lot of people about the president's big jobs plan that he announced last night before Congress.
A lot of talking going on in France as world leaders meet to talk funding for the Arab Spring.
And Nike is unveiling a product from the 1989 movie Back to the Future Part 2.
Awesome.
Wait to hear what it is, Steve.
Will I be able to travel with it?
Maybe.
Ah, that's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update from 8 p.m. American Public Media.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Let's start with the breakdown, our economy one step at a time. That's Marketplace's special look at jobs and getting America back to work.
President Obama's in Richmond, Virginia today, drumming up support for the $450 billion jobs bill he laid out last night. That was before a joint session of Congress, of course. 53% of the package is made up of tax breaks for employees and for small businesses that hire.
There should be nothing controversial about this piece of legislation. Everything in here is the kind of proposal that's been supported by both Democrats and Republicans, including many who sit here tonight.
The plan also includes about $60 billion to extend benefits to the unemployed and an equal amount on infrastructure spending.
Building a world-class transportation system is part of what made us an economic superpower. And now we're going to sit back and watch China build newer airports and faster railroads at a time when millions of unemployed construction workers could build them right here in America?
So far, the reaction from Republican leaders is about as good as the president could have hoped for. House Speaker John Boehner said the president's ideas merit consideration.
We're going to get a number of different views on the plan now. Let's start with Chris Lowe, who's chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us from New York, as he is every Friday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Chris, what do you think is the most useful thing in the president's jobs package when it comes to creating jobs?
Yeah, well, as far as getting the economy going, the two biggest things are the extension of the payroll tax cut, and then also a little bit that was mentioned in the speech but not in the formal package delivered to Congress, which would be a plan allowing almost universal refinancing of mortgages at today's current low rate, something that would be worth about $90 billion a year.
So, in other words, fixing the housing market in order to fix the job market. Chris, do you think that if this package is passed as is, which I know is a big if, that it would actually spur some real growth or just keep us out of another recession?
No, I think what we're talking about here is something that would keep us out of a recession. It's a $14 trillion economy. Half a trillion isn't going to give us 4% growth. But bear in mind that the key here is to buy time until households can repair their balance sheet. That's ongoing now for about 4 years, and this would give us a little more time to get that done.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks as always.
There's also $85 billion in the Obama package for state and local governments to help teachers and police and firefighters in their jobs, even school repair and construction. Los Angeles is the second largest city in America with nearly 4 million residents, and Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, who attended last night's speech in Washington, is with us now to talk about Mr. Obama's plan. Mr. Mayor, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
We're talking a lot of money in aid for states and local governments as well. What's this going to do for L.A.?
Well, it's going to give us an opportunity to build on a very, very ambitious program to double the size of our rail system, to synchronize our lights, repair our roads and our bridges. So there's widespread support for this. As you know, these are ideas and initiatives that Republicans and Democrats have not just supported but voted for year after year after year.
We're talking billions of dollars for schools and for repairs at schools. Why that instead of other infrastructure projects? I'm sure L.A. could use a lot of that money in other areas, right?
Well, we could use it in schools. We could use it to repair our bridges, our ports, our airports. We need to put people back to work. And in construction particularly has a 35 to 40% unemployment rate. So whether they're building a school, bridge, or an airport or a port, We want to put them back to work. And many of our schools across the nation are in a dilapidated condition. This will help to make sure that our kids have a place to learn and to compete with other people around the world.
Antonio Villaraigosa, Mayor of Los Angeles, thank you, sir.
Take care.
Let's get a little more perspective now on the president's jobs plan and tackle all those tax credits that make up more than half the proposal. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, and she's with us this morning, as she is every Friday morning. Morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Is any of this going to help? I mean, do tax credits like these create jobs?
Well, let's look at the employee portion of the payroll taxes. The idea behind those kinds of cuts is that workers spend the extra money in the economy, so that's kind of generally good. The problem is that there's really been a fundamental shift since the recession. For the past year, even though Americans got that cut, they used the extra money to pay down debt and beef up savings. So there's really not any great reason to believe that they're going to do something different with an extra $20 per pay period next year.
So we have these incentives, Jill, for the employers to hire. Is that enough for a company to pull the trigger on adding jobs?
You know, I think business owners only hire when they see an increase in demand for their goods and services. Without that, why would they add new workers, even if it's a slightly cheaper cost? I think this part of the plan is almost like cash for clunkers. You're basically paying people to buy a car that they would have already purchased. There's actually a recent study that looked at a similar employer tax credit plan from the late 70s, and it found that 70% of those tax credits were claimed for hiring workers who would have been hired anyway. So this could be just throwing a little bit of money at some company that doesn't really need it.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Thank you.
So how did we get to the point where our unemployment rate is stubbornly stuck around 9%? Well, the Brookings Institution has a report out today looking at two competing theories. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Suspend disbelief for a minute and pretend that a group of economists is partying hard and arguing. One economist spills his drink as he insists unemployment is high because there aren't enough jobs. Another spits back, there are jobs, but unemployed workers aren't educated enough to get them. Brookings labor analyst Jonathan Rothwell could mediate at a party like this. He wrote the report Brookings released today and says both sides are right. A lot of workers lost their jobs between 2007 and 2009, and companies just aren't hiring them back. But he says for a long time now, businesses also haven't been able to find enough educated workers for the jobs they do have.
I kind of think of it as a chronic illness that has plagued the economy for some time now, but it wasn't really noticed until we had a crisis.
Tim Bartik is a labor economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says the Brookings report gets it mostly right. He doesn't think education plays such a direct role in today's grim unemployment picture, but he says it is an underlying problem that has to be considered in any proposals to bring the jobless rate down.
There's not one simple policy solution that will solve a multitude of short-term and long-term economic problems.
Maybe with enough drinks, those party animal economists could hash out that kind of comprehensive strategy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, we've got more job coverage at our website, marketplace.org. And, you know, sometimes we give our Twitter addresses. Sometimes we talk about our iPhone application. There's all sorts of little things we like to tell the podcast listeners in the podcast.
Yeah, which today, you just did, as a matter of fact.
Which I just did.
Yes,
there you,
you
go.
Did.
But today I want to mention something different. I want to tell you, podcast listener, to go to iTunes and review this podcast and give us 5 stars or 4 stars or however many the maximum.
Or just tell us we stink. Whatever.
Or just tell us we're terrible.
If you think we stink, then put it
down
there.
At least let us know you're listening.
My gosh.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Well, now to some bad news on the job front. There are reports this morning that Bank of America could cut 30 to 40,000 jobs. Confidence in the bank has been dropping recently because of huge mortgage losses and lawsuits. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan is expected to say more about his cost-cutting plan Monday at an investor conference in New York. Marty Mosby is managing director at Guggenheim Partners in Memphis. He says during the 2000s, Bank of America got too big. He says the cost-cutting will look at all parts of the business.
And say, now let's focus on the customers that we service the best. Any place that we have an ancillary kind of business that isn't generating the appropriate returns, then we're going to look for an exit strategy out of that business.
Mosby says the bank has already spun off more than 20 companies. The bank's already cut 6,000 jobs this year. More restructuring means more job losses. Bank of America wouldn't comment on specific numbers this morning. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Now to the job market abroad as we look at the global perspective on business and economics. Australia has enjoyed a low unemployment rate during the entire global recession. But as reporter Stuart Cohen tells us from Sydney, all of that could be changing.
A booming mining industry and an unemployment rate of only 5% have made Australia the envy of the Western world. But for months, critics have said the country is relying on a two-speed economy, where workers and wages and mining jobs far outpace the rest of the economy. And now Heather Ridout of the Australia Industry Group thinks the tide could be turning on the country's enviable job market.
We've actually lost about 20,000 jobs since February this year in the manufacturing sector. And there are 100 here and 20 there and 30 there. And then you have one big one. You get 1,000 or 1,400 in one day. And that makes people sit and look up.
Thousands more cuts in construction, retail, and other industries have been announced in the past few months. And that has some workers worried for the first time in years.
I took a year off and I'm quite happy to be staying in the workforce right now if I can. I don't want to be without an income.
Brenda Gradwell just returned to work in April. After only 4 weeks of looking, she had two job offers from government agencies eager to make use of her decade of private sector skills. But now, even the state government she works for has announced 5,000 job cuts in its latest budget. Even with jobs, a lot of Australians are having trouble making ends meet, as high wages in the mining sector fuel inflation that hits everyone else. New data just released shows Australians are spending half their income on just the basics of living, housing, food, and transportation. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Finance ministers from the world's seven leading economies are meeting in France today. They're talking about the European debt crisis, of course.
But another thing on the agenda is the billions of dollars promised to post-revolutionary governments in the Middle East and North Africa. Reporter Julia Simon is with us now from Cairo to talk about what's at the center of this debate. Hi, Julia.
Hi, good morning.
Are the countries in the region, and I'm talking about Egypt and Tunisia and others, are they getting the money that they've been promised by the United States and others?
No, not yet. The $20 billion that the G8 promised to the region in May, the so-called Deauville Partnership on the Arab Spring, this week the Egyptian and Tunisian finance ministers announced that they still haven't seen any of that money yet. So this weekend, Egypt, Tunisia, and the Libyan National Transitional Council are at the G7 arguing their case to get that money as soon as possible.
Is it just money, Julia, or is there anything else that the revolutionary governments have been promised?
Yeah, in addition to the money, the Deauville Partnership also talks about new job creation, new free trade agreements across the Middle East, for Jordan and Morocco, too. There's even a line in there about solar power development, but at this point, a lot of it's still just talk.
Does the lack of support, I'm wondering, threaten any of the new elections?
Well, for now, the elections in Tunisia still look set for October and in Egypt for November. But the interim government still need to think about getting through the fiscal year. And Egypt especially is in loan talks with Gulf countries, thinking about its budget deficit. But it's important to remember that not everybody in these countries think that all this foreign money is a good thing. There are still a lot of people in this transitional period who are suspicious of foreign money and worry that it comes with strings attached.
Reporter Julia Simon in Cairo. Julia, many thanks.
Thank you.
Police arrested a 44-year-old California woman for stealing library books, Jeremy. The woman got caught when she tried to take more books without checking them out of the Carlsbad Library in suburban San Diego. When police searched her home, they found thousands of books scattered everywhere, mostly about cooking and crafts and animals. Investigators say she was probably going to hold a big book sale. Selling books, you know, we're talking thousands of dollars worth of books over here and selling them to people interested in cooking and crafts and animals.
What would you call that? I'm trying to think. Klepto-bookiac?
Well, the Greek word for book is vivlio, so you would call it a kleptobiblio.
Whatever it is.
She's a kleptobiblio is what she is, and we just defined it on Marketplace Midday Update.
All this week, we're looking at the economic consequences of 9/11. Today, we focus on charitable contributions. A U.S. government crackdown after the 9/11 attacks led some of the biggest Muslim American charities to shut down, and donors have been left scrambling, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Before 9/11, most of the charity raised by Muslims in the U.S. went to Muslims abroad, refugees from Afghanistan, school kids in Gaza. Then came the U.S. crackdown on charities, which continues to this day. Jennifer Turner of the ACLU says it's scared many Muslims away from giving zakat. That's the religious obligation to donate 2.5% of your income to charity.
A large number of people also have shifted their giving and no longer give to humanitarian relief organizations or Muslim charities, but instead are giving to the building of mosques locally or to local soup kitchens or shelters.
Some Muslim immigrants still send zakat directly to poor family members, schools, or orphanages back home. But overall, much less money is flowing abroad, and that has an upside for domestic charities, like the Inner City Muslim Action Network on Chicago's South Side, which hosts evening discussions about Islam.
Does anybody know the name of the brother in the hadith? He comes to the Prophet.
Rami Neshashibi founded the group, which has grown in the post-9/11 charitable vacuum. The budget's up from $200,000 to $2 million. They run a free medical clinic, arts, and anti-violence programs.
9/11 led to increase in funding from individual donors who felt like this is really a important part of our work that, quite frankly, we were neglecting.
Another fundraising winner is civil rights groups that fight discrimination against Muslims. Nihad Awad says his group, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, has expanded from 8 offices to 30. With so much money staying in the U.S., he says American Islam is getting a makeover.
Mosques that used to be built with maybe $500,000 now are being built with $5 million.
And Awad says don't be surprised to see lots of cash in the collection box.
In some functions, people do not give credit card information or don't give checks. They just safely they give cash.
That's to keep your charity humble before God and invisible to U.S. government investigators. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The solar company Solyndra was the very first company to receive federal loan guarantees from the Energy Department to help create green jobs. But earlier this week, the firm filed for bankruptcy, and yesterday, the FBI and the Department of Energy's Inspector General raided the company's Northern California offices. From Silicon Valley, here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
Back in 2009, Solyndra received more than $500 million in loan guarantees to build a new plant and create more than 1,000 high-tech solar jobs. But it couldn't compete against a wave of cheaper Chinese imports. Solyndra lost hundreds of millions of dollars and went bankrupt this week. The FBI wouldn't comment on the details of yesterday's raid, but the involvement of the Department of Energy's Inspector General suggests the probe is focusing on the DOE loan guarantees. Ronnie Green's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, a nonpartisan investigative reporting group. He says the Department of Energy failed to complete due diligence before extending loan guarantees to Solyndra.
What we found was when they made that announcement back in March of 2009, they didn't have either a full legal or a full marketing review in hand.
Green also found that more than $1 billion in loan guarantees went to companies like Solyndra that were financed by President Obama's political fundraisers. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, Nike is releasing a limited edition sneaker based on the pair of shoes that lights up from the 1989 movie Back to the Future Part 2.
I remember those shoes.
In the movie, the shoes actually laced themselves.
I remember that. That was so cool.
Sadly, the new Nike shoes will not lace themselves. But the real disappointment for me is that Nike is releasing a product from Back to the Future Part 2 that is not a hoverboard.
Oh,
I will buy
I thought it was
a hoverboard.
The hoverboard.
Any company.
You teased me with with that.
I know. Any company that will make a hoverboard knows that they have at least one customer in me, and I will even buy those light-up shoes.
But remember, the hoverboard cannot hover over water.
That's true, but, you know.
Not that it matters.
Fine. The price you pay for a hoverboard. I don't care.
Get this man a hoverboard, for goodness sakes.
Get me a hoverboard.
My gosh.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Have a great weekend. I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.